This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
Welcome. This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast show. Our community is made up of so many amazing and diverse groups of people, as are the programs on Joy 94.9. There's something here for everyone. A Little Pot of Joy is where we highlight just some of these amazing programs.
We would like to show our respect and acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, of elders past and present, of the Kulin Nation, whose land we are broadcasting from. That was Alice.
Thanks for having me on the show, Andrea. It's been a while.
And she's our very special guest this evening.
Oh, thanks, Andrea. We're opening the evening with a podcast from The Informer, legislation surrounding hormone treatment for young trans people.
The number of children transitioning has risen exponentially over the past few years. The Royal Children's Hospital is expecting at least 250 referrals this year.
The transition process for children is twofold. After a child has undergone extensive medical and psychological assessment, they can be prescribed hormone blockers to suppress the onset of puberty.
The second stage of transition is to start hormone therapy, either testosterone or estrogen, to facilitate transition. But the family must get permission from the family court's judge to begin hormones, delaying the child's physical development.
Naomi and Isabella join Shannon, Stephanie and Emma to discuss the long and drawn-out legal process. At a time where other children are developing into adults, transgender children have their puberty suppressed for many years, increasing both social and mental stress for the child.
So if you can't listen to The Informer live, podcasts are available for download from the Joy website, joy.org.au/The Informer, or download them from the iTunes store.
This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
Good evening and welcome to your Monday night edition of The Informer on Joy 94.9. My name is Shannon Power and I will be your host this evening along with Stephanie McLean and Emma Arnold. The number of children transitioning has risen exponentially over the past few years. The Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne is expecting to receive at least 250 referrals this year alone. The medical process for children to transition is twofold. First, they're prescribed hormone blockers, which are approved by a doctor, a child's parent or guardian, after the child has undergone psychological assessment. Next, they need to start hormone therapy, either taking estrogen or testosterone to help them transition. But a family has to get permission of a family court judge to begin that therapy. The traumatic court process for trans children is both preventing them from quick and easy access to crucial hormones. A group called Parents of Gender Diverse Children travelled to Canberra earlier this year to petition lawmakers to change the law.
Isabel McNamara started transitioning when she was just 10 years old and is now 13. She joins us on the line with her mum, Naomi, and they want to share with us their experience of going through the family court process or pre-court process. Naomi and Isabel, welcome to The Informer.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Are you there?
We're both here, yeah.
Oh, great. I believe you're sharing a phone, so I hope you can hear us.
Yeah.
We're all here. I'm here with Shannon and Emma. Thanks for joining us and for, you know, coming out and being so passionate about this issue and wanting to share your story with us. Can you tell us what your experience has been like so far? So it's been 3 years, I believe, since Isabel began her transition process.
Isabel told us how she was feeling just after her 10th birthday and transitioned fairly soon after that, within a couple of months of that discussion. We've had a pretty positive experience. We live in a small country town and Isabel goes to school in a slightly bigger small country town. And so we were a little bit concerned about, you know, what the reaction would be and you know, we're still trying to grapple with it ourselves, I guess. And we had a really positive experience from the school and from the broader community. We've had a lot of support, which has been wonderful.
So just to give us an idea, how important is it to know that you do have that positive support around you?
For me as a parent, it's incredibly important. It just gives you some level of confidence that things are going to be okay. One of the first thoughts that both Andrew and I had when Isabel told us was, you know, how difficult are things going to be for her, and we worried about her safety and you know, a whole range of things. So to know that you have a supportive community behind you, a supportive school behind you, makes all the difference in the world.
Well, it's good that you had that support on a local scale, but then I guess the offhand of that is that on a more statewide or even countrywide scale, the entire court is almost against the whole, you know, the process should be as easy as possible, and there are so many barriers preventing it. So do you feel that the whole process would have been easier if the country was supporting you as well as your local support?
Oh, look, absolutely. I think there certainly is a need for some legislative reform around and removing the family court from the process of accessing treatment. And, you know, you mentioned stage one treatment up until a couple of years ago required families and young people to attend court to get approval for hormone blockers as well. And we're very, very fortunate that a family, a wonderful family, you know, stuck their neck out and did the hard yards and overturned that decision. So now, you know, all children across Australia no longer have to present to family court for approval for stage one. But unfortunately, we're in a position where young people still have to attend court to get approval for stage two treatment. So that's the court is essentially assessing whether or not a child is guilt competent, so that is, a child is able to make a medical decision of that type.
So, Naomi, just give us an idea of where you are in that stage. Have you begun petitioning the family court in order for Isabel to access her hormone treatment, or where are you exactly in the process?
We're not there yet, so we're still a couple of years away from having to do that, and we'll be guided by the specialist at the Royal Children's Hospital is to the right time for that. But I guess we want to ensure that Isabel is never put in that position. And that's why we, along with a lot of other families and young people, are working really hard to advocate for a change in this area.
And Naomi, what are some of the implications of young people who have had to go through the process of facing the family court in order to get their hormone treatment? Do you know of any of those implications?
Yeah, look, it's certainly delayed treatment for a lot of young people, which can have really devastating effects on young people. It certainly increases their stress levels in an already incredibly stressful situation, and has a massive impact on their mental health and their general well-being. So, if a young person, is petitioning the court for approval for stage two, and they're not on blockers, then they are, you know, feminising or masculinising when they don't actually want to or need to, because there's treatment available to prevent that. So that has long-lasting impacts on them, you know, on their sense of self, really.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Isabel, tell us a little bit about your transitioning process. How is it going for you, and how have you found it so far?
Pretty good, mostly. But it was a bit hard at first, but after about a year, people get used to it and everything's okay.
And what's the best part of, you know, going through the process?
Best part?
I'm sure there's a lot of awesome parts to it.
Being able to be me.
Yeah, absolutely. So do you... I know that, like, all this law stuff and legal stuff can be a bit tricky to get your head around. How much, I guess, do you understand about what the next process is for you to get onto to the hormones? Is it something that you... Is it something that you understand well, or is it, you know, you're being guided by your parents and the doctor?
I understand completely stage two, and they understand the worries people might have about it, but I still don't think it's a good enough excuse for people to feel what they feel in that time.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're the person who is transitioning. You're the person who's actually going through it. Your doctors can support you and your parents can support you. But I think it's important for us to understand from your own brain and your own mouth, why is it so important that this law changes?
because, well, for me personally, if I have to go through almost all of high school, I won't be able to feminize until I'm about 17. Well, I don't know, that I just couldn't go through that, watching everyone else go through this, and I won't even mature for a very long time. This kind of hurts me and makes me feel very stressed. It's not fair.
Absolutely.
Sorry to interrupt you, Isabel. How do you, having been linked up with the Children's Hospital and meeting all the doctors and professionals that are obviously guiding you through this process, do you feel that support, you're getting enough support through the hospital system rather than having to go and have the sign-off from the family courts as well?
I feel like I get more than enough from the hospital. The family court shouldn't have any say in it. My doctors know what's right for me, and they are the only people and me who should have a say. Only me and my doctors should have a say in what I have.
Yeah, absolutely. And with an issue like this, a lot of people don't know about it because it doesn't affect them. But do you think that if more people understood, there would be a bigger change?
Yes, if more people actually took the time to understand this situation, they would understand that everything we go through, we don't just do it because we feel like, because we just want to be a girl or a boy. We are these people and we shouldn't have to be hidden from it.
Well, that's a very powerful statement indeed. I think, you're very brave to come and chat to us about it, Isabel, and we're very grateful to hear what you have to say. But just one last question to finish off for you and your mum, Naomi. How far are you guys willing to go in this fight, and how can the community support you?
Do you want me to answer that?
Yeah.
sorry, sharing the phone.
No, you're
all right. We're willing to do whatever it takes. I mean, we've travelled to Canberra a couple of times now and spoken to some great allies up there, and Isabel and I had the opportunity to present as part of a panel with some other wonderful parents and young people, and we're willing to do that again. We're willing to do whatever it takes. We'd be really, you know, happy for, I guess, in terms of what the community can do is I guess just to open their minds a little bit for those minds that may be a little closed right now and understand that this, you know, accessing this treatment is not a choice that people necessarily make. Certainly it's not something that Isabel is choosing to do. It's something that is absolutely necessary for her long-term health and well-being. So to be faced with a decision where you know you have to access the treatment and then to have to go to family court to get approval for that treatment feels really unjust, and it feels like she's being punished for something that you know she hasn't actually had any control over. So it is, you know, it's not in step with anything that's happening internationally. Australia is the only jurisdiction where this is required. It's just a little bit outmoded, and it's time for a change. So I would urge the community to get on board with this when there is any an opportunity to spread the word or to advocate, and you know, we're really happy to work with the Chief Justice and the Family Court and any politician who is in a position to assist us. And we've had some fantastic support already from Cathy McGowan and Janet Rice and Warren Ench. We've been very, very lucky.
Well, it's wonderful to hear, and unfortunately we've got to wrap it up now because we're out of time, but thank you so much for coming and joining us on The Informer this evening. You're both wonderful women, and we really appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye. That was Naomi and Isabel McNamara.
You're on Joy 94.9, and this is All Part of Joy with your host Andrea and Alice.
Up next, part two from The Informer, legislation surrounding hormone treatment for young trans people.
Mona, a Melbourne transgender woman, joins Stephanie, Emma and Shannon to discuss the difficulties facing gender-diverse children.
The large number of issues arises from having to apply to the family courts to access stage 2 of the transition treatment, which creates unnecessary social, mental and physical stress.
As a gender-diverse child, they must get court authority to transition. At what point do people in courts get a medical certificate to be able to judge the health and well-being of an individual?
With a 2-year waiting list to access the courts and an additional 2-year waiting list to access stage 2 medical assistance, that has an immense impact on a person's life.
So if you missed the Informer Live, podcasts are available for download from the Joy website, joy.org.au/The Informer, or download them from the iTunes store.
You're listening to A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9 with Stephanie McLean, Emma Arnold and Shannon Power. Now, earlier on, I actually had the chance to speak with Mona, a Melbourne trans woman, and we spoke for actually over 20 minutes. I think it was nearly a good half hour. And it was honestly so good to hear everything she had to say about her experiences, because she was as equally honest and insightful about it all. Obviously, we don't have time for the whole half hour, but here is a quick snippet that relates to what we spoke about today. People questioning why we're having this conversation, why it's so in the media right now, is because this is so ridiculously important.
Yeah. And I mean, we've seen a lot of strides for trans awareness, but that people think it's over so quickly. And it's not, because you don't have to live it. You don't have to deal with it. I mean, in terms of my family, I've got two immediate family who are teachers, and my sister's partner as well is also a teacher. And they've said to me, you know, before understanding that you were trans, it was hard to have this connection with students who might end up coming to you through the Safe Schools program, or even just saying, you know, being comfortable enough to say to you, I am trans, or I've got questions about gender identity. And saying that you know somebody who is trans allows you to really make a personal connection and understand that it is just a person sitting in front of you who's said, I'm not changing who I am, I'm just changing how I want to exist in the world.
Yeah, it's not like you've decided this is who I am. It's that you are who you are and you're just voicing it.
Exactly.
And you should be allowed to voice it freely.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, on that topic, as gender-diverse children must apply to the family court for stage 2 treatment involving gender-changing hormones, this creates a large number of issues, both mentally and physically, for children who identify as trans. In what ways do you think this separates trans people from the rest of the LGBTIQA community?
So I think the biggest issue there is that you need to undertake a legal process to be justified as who you are, rather than in terms of being gay or lesbian. You know, I mean, a lot of people will think that you've made a choice or anything like that, but there's no legal process for being acknowledged as gay or lesbian.
Yet there's one for trans people.
Yeah, in terms of being trans, or rather in terms of being a trans child.
Like, you have to get a certificate of approval.
Exactly.
And that exists nowhere else in this community.
It's really upsetting to say that you need to seek our approval to be who you are, or rather to even explore who you are. There's no other childhood developmental process where you'll have to go through the courts. I mean, you just end up making life more difficult for these kids, and then you say, oh, we're just trying to make you safer. It's like, well, if you're trying to make us safer, listen to what we're trying to say. And we're saying, make it easier for us to access these things.
Don't put out this idea that we need your approval.
It ends up saying you need to be subservient to us,
our norms and our standards. And of course it is important that youth who identify as trans and their families seek advice and seek help, and it should be readily available at all times, but that should not come from the courts. Because at what point do people in the courts get a medical certificate?
At what point do people in the courts think that the trans children coming to them, having considered this, there's no person who says, I want to identify as another gender, who hasn't gone through a self-questioning process and even a medical process. There's not many medical procedures where you need a legal intervention before you undertake it, and especially one so passive as hormone treatment.
And especially one that is so infringing on the possibility to have a successful transition, because the waiting list can be up to 2 years.
Yeah, and that's just through the courts.
Through
the medical procedure prior to going to the courts, it's just as long. So you're looking at up to a four-year wait time before you can even transition, and you're already going through puberty. It's a really difficult idea, and it's not like you're going to be going through all this without having thought about it first. And a lot of the time, families don't have the money to take their children through this process. I've got several friends who just had to be binding and doing it. You know, binding's a very dangerous process. Why must we go through that rather than allowing us to develop in the way that we've identified we want to develop as?
Absolutely. 50 to 60% of trans people experience depression or related disorders. Do you think this is a reflection of the culture in Australia or a lack of understanding that could be fixed with better education programs?
Well, we've all been in high school and we've all seen what kids do to other kids, but when you're even more different, it just takes it that whole step further to say that, you know, you're completely this otherness that people don't really find it easy to comprehend.
And some people fear it, especially in high school. And from that fear comes the bullying, comes the hatred, and comes just disgusting treatment.
Exactly. And, I mean, seeing other kids bully each other, it sort of normalizes that behavior. And when somebody is that other, it's so easy to point the spotlight away from you and towards them and say, why do you want to wear the dress? Why do you want to... Yeah, it's just really upsetting to know that kids who couldn't deal with bullying in the first place are now having to deal with a whole nother level where they're most likely losing friends just because they're trying to say, this is who I am. I want to share this with you.
Now, 10 months ago, a South Australian LGBTI and asylum seeker advocate was voted into the Australian Senate. Robert Sims was expected to serve a six-year term, a typical Senate term, but recently with the double dissolution, election has changed those plans, and Robert lost his seat to Family First's Bob Day. Now, speaking of technical issues, well, I guess an election isn't a technical issue, but anyway. Shannon, tell us what happened with old mate Robert today.
So, old mate Robert, we couldn't get him on the phone. He's in Adelaide tonight. Maybe the time delay or something messed up his phone, who knows? But I actually had the good fortune of speaking to him earlier this afternoon for the Star Observer, where I work, and he sort of was a bit reflective on his time in the Senate. I mean, when you become a senator, you expect that you'll either do your 3 or 6 year term. You don't expect it to get the boot after 10 months. So I feel like he just had started to get the wheels in motion and really gain some momentum in the stuff that he was advocating for. He said he was sad and disappointed that, you know, he got a short stint, but he's 32. Like, he'll be back. He's going to go on holiday. He's a baby. He's going to try find a boyfriend because, you know, being in the Senate is too busy to date. So I think he's going to try and do some, you know, fun, normal people stuff. Maybe get on Grindr, who knows? Yes. And, you know, best of luck to him. He's a good-looking guy. But I think his reflection was he was disappointed. They had anticipated he might lose his seat, but he said he was quite proud of the work that he'd done. So we need to remember he was a very vocal supporter of trans kids. He really vocally supported safe schools, but he was one of the first federal politicians to really fight to have PrEP, which is pre-exposure prophylaxis, a HIV preventative drug. He really fought for that to be introduced into the TGA and on the PBS. So he might have only been there for 10 months, but he was a really strong ally for the community.
And everything I said about feeling good after the election.
And there's still, you know, advocates in there. There's, you know, Lee Rhiannon, and there's still heaps of LGBTI advocates in the parliament. Yeah. He was just a really good one.
Yeah, and a young one, and someone who's really been, you know, as a young person, a pretty strong role model for future politicians, and somebody who's paved the way for LGBTI rights in Australia. So we owe our thanks
Yeah, we can't wait to have him back. So a little earlier on we were talking about how young trans people need to go into the family court in order to get permission to go on hormone therapy if they're under 18. We've had a text come in on 0427JOY949 and the person has asked, could I ask in regards to the court appearance, is it an adversarial process or just a formality? It is something that they have to go through, so it's a necessary process. It's part of the law, so I don't know if I would call that a formality, but it's a necessity for people under the age of 18 to start hormone therapy.
Okay, well, that's pretty much all we've got time for. A big thank you to all of our guests this evening, Naomi and Isabel McNamara, Mona, and, well, would have been Robert Sims, but
Shannon Power filling in for Robert Sims.
Hopefully we'll get him on at a later stage in the week. I'm Stephanie McLean.
Signing off for the last time. Thanks for everything, Steph. I'm Shannon Power.
And I'm Emma Arnold.
And thanks for joining us.
You're listening to Joy 94.9, and this is A Little Pot of Joy with Andrea and Alice today.
Next, we have a podcast from Broad, Gay, Lesbian, Then and Now.
Sonia is joined by Shirlene Robinson, co-author of Gay, Lesbian, Then and Now.
Over 70 years, Australia has quietly undergone one of the biggest social revolutions in history. Once viewed as criminal, sinners, or sick, lesbians and gay men are increasingly accepted as equal, and the majority of Australians support same-sex marriage. This rapid transformation in social attitudes has widened the space for lesbians and gays to live ordinary and visible lives in ways that were once barely imaginable.
Through the intimate life stories of 13 gay and lesbian Australians ranging in age from 20 to 80, Gay and Lesbian Then and Now reveals the legacies of homophobia, the personal struggles and triumphs involved in coming out, the inconsistent state of social progress, and the many different ways of being gay or lesbian in Australia then and now.
So if you couldn't listen to the show live, podcasts are available for download from the Joy website, joy.org.au/broad, or from the iTunes store.
This is A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
This is Sonia for Broad, and we're very fortunate to speak to co-author Dr. Shirlene Robinson about a book called Gay and Lesbian, Then and Now, Australian Stories from a Social Revolution. Welcome to Broad.
Thank you for talking with me.
Excellent. And so tell us a bit about yourself and what led you to get involved in writing, putting this book together?
Well, Robert and myself, who's the co-author, we're both historians who work at Macquarie University and identify as members of the LGBT community. And we were really interested, I guess, in using oral history interviews to look at the way that gay and lesbian people have experienced a lot of the really dramatic social changes of the last 60 years.
Yeah, well, it is quite a very interesting aspect they've put on it as a social revolution. And calling it that, what was the impetus as part of the content and as part of the name of the book to call it a social revolution?
I think we were inspired by the fact that if you have a look back to, I guess, how people thought about homosexuality, really, I guess, until the quite recent past, something really dramatic and significant has changed. So we could be talking about, you know, the 1960s where people were going through forcible treatment in the medical profession, or up to even in New South Wales, you know, the 1984 when it was illegal to engage in male-to-male sexual activity. And now we're talking about a situation where 72% of Australians support marriage equality. So those changes have occurred quite quickly, and it led us to argue that that rapid transformation in attitudes really has been something of a revolution.
Mm. Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. You do call it, though, a sort of a quiet or silent revolution, not the sort of raging, I mean, sort of things that maybe some people expect. Is that an Australian, do you think that's an Australian thing in particular? So it's, we didn't have a stone wall exactly?
You raise an interesting point. So I guess a lot of the social change I think that has happened for gay and lesbian people particularly, I think it's been very important what has happened internationally. So, you know, things like Stonewall do have, I think, a really big historic importance. And, you know, obviously in Australia we had Mardi Gras in 1978, yes, which was a really important turning point as well, so that public visibility. But I think there's something that's also been happening, I guess, within the workplace and within homes and in discussions between people. So the people that we were interested in talking to were perhaps people whose stories hadn't been told. You know, there's been some really interesting work that's been done on activists, who were very important, but we were really interested in looking at the stories of people that you might think of as being sort of more ordinary, everyday people, and to look at what life had been like for them, you know, over the course of the past 60 years or so.
Yeah, that's interesting indeed. And also for our show, looking at feminism, looking at women and their experiences and their journey and stories that they have. Did that sort of also come out in your investigations as you were doing the research about, you know, women's experiences in particular within the community?
Yeah. I think it was really interesting. So, you know, the book, obviously, we interviewed gay men and lesbians, but it became quite clear that there's very different experiences that have happened historically for those two groups of people. They've both been subjected to discrimination. For women, definitely women sort of, you know, I guess, who came of age during the women's movement, that's an incredibly powerful and significant force in their lives for a lot of them. Mm. And it really does, I think, give them a sense of community, which is very important, and a sense of support, which is important. So a lot of people will talk about that as being something that really does empower them quite significantly of a particular generation.
Yes. And as you were going through, the research, did you find we're now looking at millennials? Any sort of differences that, you know, jumped out at you in regards to that?
Well, I think that it's quite the biggest change that you can sort of see coming through, and it's hard to, I guess it kind of reflects a lot of debates that have been happening within the community, but there's sort of a bit of a move towards people perhaps wanting to live lives that we might consider as being more ordinary, whereas in the past perhaps people were, particularly people in the LGBT community, were more interested, I guess, in this idea of transgressive experiences and sort of, you know, the rich culture that came from, I guess, being outside of society. Mm. Since for our millennials, there's been much more of a move towards being ordinary, living a sort of fairly ordinary suburban life. And, you know, it's interesting because that's something that wouldn't have been possible, you know, for the sort of earlier people that we interviewed. In terms of the question of feminism and whether that's, I guess, important for younger people, it's not really something that came up as much in the course of our interviews. And I suppose in that sense, perhaps that is something that might reflect interviews that you perhaps might do with younger straight people. They might sort of not talk about it so much as being a force, which is a really interesting question, I think, for feminism more broadly about what people think it is and making people understand that it is something that is important and influential and helpful in life.
Mm. I guess with the history too of the movements themselves, how they kind of blended and have both, you know, experienced that connection to one another with civil rights movements and things like feminism and, of course, queer rights, gay and lesbian, LGBTIQ rights and equality. Sort of things have merged over time. So do you think that's a trend for the future?
It's really interesting. So I guess because we sort of did this book and, you know, we talked about a lot of, really, some of our people were born, like Merv, one of the guys that's in the start of the book, he can remember, you know, World War II. So there's a big sort of span of ages in the book. And, you know, if you look at it, it looks like in some ways, I guess you could say the book shows that perhaps life is becoming a little bit easier for gay and lesbian people. But as a historian, I think the co-author, Robert, and I would both be a little bit hesitant to predict what the future might hold. You know, you can move forward, but things can also swing and there can be backlashes and things like that. So I think, if anything, it just shows, I guess, you know, what has been a remarkable social change and I guess a move towards equality and acceptance, and certainly one that I hope will continue to progress.
Mm. And while you were doing, as a woman, while you were doing the book yourself, what sort of, you know, what sort of questions did you have about your own self, if any, when you were talking to a lot of the people that are in the book?
I, I suppose because I identify as being a lesbian myself, that was, it was interesting. You know, you feel like you would have, I guess, some sort of understanding and connection with a lot of the other women. And I thought, you know, that was quite a nice thing to go into the interviews and do. But I guess the way that women and men tell their stories often can be quite different. So I would go in there with a bit of an awareness about that. I was, because in my non-university life I do a little bit of work around marriage equality, I was always quite interested to see how people viewed that without, of course, sort of expressing my own views on that issue. So that was one that I was, you know, found quite interesting, the way people viewed relationships and I guess had commitment to each other or didn't have commitment to each other in a pre-marriage equality era, and perhaps what they might make of it today, because that's been a very rapid shift. So that's something that interested me a little bit.
Now, some of the characters, are just looking at some of the women that you obviously interviewed and spoke to and connected with as such, there are people that such a wide diversity of people with, I was going to say characters, because they come across as characters and some amazing journey there. You've got a woman who, in the 70s, people like Jenny, who didn't feel that she was not hesitant, but she didn't really want to stand out. And then later on in the book, you've got women that are definitely, you know, very comfortable with their identity and aren't ashamed or whatever, or don't feel any hesitancy to stand out. What was it like talking to those women and those differences?
Oh, it's really interesting. I guess it does show you to some extent how you are formed by the era that you grow up in. So Jenny, who you mentioned, you know, came of age at a time when lesbianism was something that really wasn't spoken of at all. So she had to develop her sense of, I guess, identity as a woman and also her sense of identity as a lesbian at a time when there were very few representations of that. Whereas younger people, and I think you might be referring to Alex, who's also in the book, grew up when there were sort of many more images of lesbians in the media or in a school where it was quite okay to be openly lesbian, and that's like, something that would be unimaginable, I think, to somebody like Jenny or perhaps even Nola, who grew up a little bit earlier than Jenny. Yeah. That the way that, that if you had sort of told them that, you know, there'll be schools where it'd be absolutely accepted to, you know, bring your same-sex partner to a ball or a formal or something like that, it would have been unbelievable.
It's and it's such a short time, really. It's not even 100 years that you're covering. It's a relatively pretty short period of time, I guess.
And that's why it was interesting to speak to some of the older people, I guess, because they have just sort of, watched this happen and over the course of their life, and the way that their sexual identity has sort of, gotten more and more mainstream attention and more recognition, more visibility. And I guess what that has meant for their sense of self has been a fascinating thing to talk to them about and to try and capture for the National Library of Australia, which was another, I guess, important part of the project that we worked with the National Library of Australia. So they'll give a home to the 60 interviews that we did as part of the broader project, which is also really lovely to think.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is amazing.
Joy.
You're listening to Joy 94.9 and this little pod of joy with your hosts, Andrea and Alice.
Next, we have a podcast from Saturday Magazine, Tin and Brady, Marriage Equality Australia.
Tin and Brady from Marriage Equality Australia joins Macca and Tass to discuss marriage equality in relations to the 2016 federal election and what this means for the LGBTIQ community.
And if you just can't listen to the show live, podcasts are available for download from the Joy website, joy.org.au/Saturday Magazine, or the iTunes Store.
You're listening to A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program.
You're listening to Saturday Magazine.
Our next guest is Tin and Brady from Marriage Equality Australia, and we've actually asked him to come on board and have a conversation with us this morning about what does this election mean. Good morning, Tin.
Morning. Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So what does this election mean for our marriage equality? What's your assessment of the situation so far?
I suppose there's two or three things emerge from it. You know, there's a couple of definites already, and then there's one or two things that aren't clear. The definites are there have never been more members of the lower house elected who are in favour of marriage equality. And we don't have the final number yet, but we already know that we have got more people from every single party elected who are in favour of marriage.
Well, that's a great outcome in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think sometimes we have to own our victories as we work out what our next step is all the time. So, you know, that in itself is brilliant news. And it's great that they're from every single party, because I think, you know, one of the lessons we had in Ireland very clearly was it was very important to make sure we had voices from every part of the political spectrum on this, because, you know, there are gay people in every party and gay people vote for every party, along with their mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters. So that's really empowering for people, hopefully.
Yes.
The second piece that's really good news, and I think Adam was about to talk about it before, was we've never had as many, well, I was about to say LGBT MPs and senators, but it's mostly L and G still. Unfortunately, we don't have, we haven't got any trans people elected at this point. But, you know, in the lower house now, we have at least four. And then in the upper house, there's another three. So that's a really, that's very powerful to have those voices within each party.
And that's open. That's openly L and G MPs, really, isn't it? So there may be a few others.
I think, there are a few, but and that's all right.
That's okay. Yeah, exactly. Then I think within, that's a really powerful dynamic within party rooms. You know, because you stop talking about lesbian and gay people in the abstract.
Yeah.
When there's a lesbian and gay person in the room, and one of the great developments of this election is now both Liberal and Labour, in particular, have, you know, lesbian and gay people inside their party rooms, and people can see this is about a real person, their lives, their families, you know, someone who lives on your street or sits across from you at work, you know, and I think that's a transfer, potentially a transformative moment within party rooms.
Actually, Tienan, one of our listeners has just emailed in and said that in the lower house, there are four gay and lesbian MPs, three are Liberal and one is Labour. Now, that in itself is quite interesting, that the more conservative of the parties actually has delivered three openly.
But also, sorry, Tina and Tess, what it says is also is that, you know, a couple of those Liberal gay MPs are quite conservative. So, you know, there's often an assumption made, and you quite rightly pointed out that, you know, our community vote for all parties. But there's often an assumption made that the LGBTI community is to the left, and that's actually not.
No, we're a broad church, aren't we?
We are actually a broad church.
It always strikes me, it turns out LGBT people are exactly the same as people.
That's right.
Which is the point we've always been trying to make about marriage, and it's true about politics too. I mean, and it's not unique to Australia. I think one of the most powerful advocates in Ireland for the marriage equality referendum that was held there was Leo Varadkar, who is the Minister for Health, who came out as a gay man. And, you know, that's a very centre-right party.
Yes.
You know? And the leaders from the LGBT political community were very much centre-right.
Yes. So Tienan, do we now have an absolute majority of MPs who support marriage equality in the lower house?
If there was a free vote without a whip by the parties, we absolutely do.
Yes.
We don't have final numbers yet, but we're well in excess of 80, 85 MPs who have publicly said that they are for marriage equality. And I suppose the challenge then, and the bit that is unclear as we wait for the final numbers and as we wait for what the government is going to look like and what the Senate will look like,
yes,
is, you know, what's the pathway to making marriage equality a reality now?
Yes.
Because we know we have more supporters, we know we have more gay and lesbian people in there, you know, we know also, and I think it's just so important for us always to remind politicians, we know that 70% of Australians, even in that Fairfax poll the day of the election, 70% of Australians are for marriage equality, and they're a majority of people in every single party of the voters. So it's all about, you know, now's the time for politicians especially to work together to deliver a pathway, because this is the will of the people, and it's time we, in the clearest, hopefully simplest way possible, made it a reality by the end of the year.
Do you see the fact that the coalition have just scraped over the line, and there's been some criticism within the coalition of how marriage equality was a fairly strong part of the campaign, that, do you see this vote for the government, this belated election, as a rejection of a plebiscite? Do you think people actually...
You know, it's so hard to read, because, of course, most people vote on dozens and dozens and dozens of issues. And we all have our own individual weighting system of whether it's education or health or roads or marriage equality. And of course, you know, 90-something percent of people aren't gay. So, you know, more likely their weighting system was probably other policies. I think the more important point for us as well, you know, now is, especially when we have, you know, a very tight majority, is that political parties need to work together. And the one thing we do know is it is absolutely legally unnecessary to have a plebiscite. Before we even talk about the impact of it or the pros and cons politically, there's no one out there saying this is a legal requirement. You know, Ireland had to do this because it was a constitutional referendum, We were legally bound to have a public vote. And that's not the case here. So if it can be avoided politically, if parties can work together to make sure they can avoid it politically, they should try their best to do that, and we should try our best to help them.
And it's important to remember that when the Marriage Act was changed, when Nicola Roxon, to her great shame for Labor and the Liberals, when it was changed, the Liberal Party, who was in majority government, didn't think that to change the Marriage Act needed a plebiscite.
Yeah, I mean, and of course they were right. It doesn't need a plebiscite in the same way that we know now everybody else is right when we say it doesn't need a plebiscite to institute marriage equality in Australia. And I think it's probably, it's so understandable. I know over the few months that I've been here and met, you know, so many groups around the country, the real level of frustration among especially LGBT people, but their families, their parents and their supporters, to know that this isn't required, but politically we may have to face it.
So what does this election really mean for the plebiscite? Do you think that the plebiscite has lost its mandateness? Is there such a word?
We can invent. I learned the political journey of getting marriage equality in Australia is being invented every day. I think we can invent some words to go with it as well. look, it's hard to tell right now. There'll be internal party room discussions to come up. We don't know what dynamic is going to take place within those party rooms about, you know, which side of the party, let's say in the Liberals or Labour, is stronger. You know, what we do know is we have two party leaders, Bill Shorten and Malcolm Turnbull, who are both for marriage equality. So that's good. We should bank that as a victory and work out influence insofar as we can and make sure we do everything we can to have our voice heard within Parliament about why we think it is unnecessary, why we know it is unnecessary, and why it would be preferable in every scenario to have this done by a straightforward vote. It's very hard to read the dynamic inside the party rooms at this stage. I think it'll be an animal all of its own over the coming weeks.
Mm.
Look, it's going to be very interesting times, and I know we're going to be speaking to you quite a bit. I just want to ask, are you enjoying living in Australia? It's quite different to Ireland, isn't it?
I was coming to the office the other day in a shirt and everyone else had a coat and a scarf on. So that was the first inclination. So, yes, I'm certainly enjoying the climate. Everyone keeps telling me it's cold and I'm looking at them like they're slightly mad.
Yeah.
The people are amazing. We've met so many groups from around the country and so many individuals, you know, working on this. We just want to, you know, get it done by whatever path we have to face to do it. And so most of what I've been doing so far is meeting people, and that's always, you know, the best way to learn about a country. And it's been brilliant so far. I think anyone listening to the program could take great faith in knowing that, you know, in every corner of Australia, there are people who are just the most amazing advocates. From parents to brothers and sisters to LGBT people, you know, and over the next few months, whichever path we do face, you know, we have to make sure all those voices are heard in all of those places where Australians live.
We do. Tiernan Brady, thank you so much for your time. I know we're going to be talking to you again, enjoy the cold.
Thanks very much. I'll talk to you anytime.
You're on Joy 94.9 with Andrea and Alice, and we've come to the end of another evening of A Little Pot of Joy.
There are so many more programs on Joy 94.9, producing a diverse range of content and podcasts.
Even your favourite program from the past will have a podcast, so you can go back and listen to your favourite Joy moment.
You can find the complete podcast from tonight's show on the Joy website, joy.org.au, or download them from the iTunes store.
And hey, thanks for having me, Andrea.
Thank you for coming along.
Oh, I thought it was fun.
You've been listening to A Little Pot of Joy, the podcast program. See joy.org.au and click on our podcast link to subscribe to your favourite podcasts free.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.